Get your daily market recap on the latest stock updates, monetary policy decisions, and key results and statistics that may impact your trading. Schwab Market Update is an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Listen today at schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast or wherever you get your podcasts.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene, along with Jonathan Farrow and Lisa Abramowitz. Join us each day for insight from the best in economics, geopolitics, finance, and investment. Subscribe to Bloomberg Surveillance On Demand on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere you get your podcasts. And always on Bloomberg.com, the Bloomberg Terminal, and the Bloomberg Business App. Richard Clarett is with us, Global Economic Advisor at PIMCO, and student of his economic history. Professor Clarida, somebody spoke of creative destruction this morning, and that reminded me of a guy named Hyman Minsky, who long ago and far away had Schumpeter as his doctoral advisor. And of course, Hyman Minsky in the lore talks about a Minsky moment, or maybe talks about the efficacy of regulation. Let's bring over the cacophony of another time in Hyman Minsky over to what Michael Barr at the Fed needs to do. What is the best outcome of the new bank regulation and the lessons we're learning in this March?
Well, I think that, there's been a lot of progress. Dodd-Frank, and in particular for the large systemically important institutions with stress testing and liquidity and all the rest. I think what this episode does reveal is that institutions may look small, they can get big. As you know, SVB, for example, tripled in size in a couple of years, and even institutions of that size, as we saw over the weekend, can be systemic. So I think the clear direction of travel is going to be that under existing statutes and laws, the Fed has enormous flexibility in the way that it supervises institutions on a case-by-case basis. And I think we're going to see that level of supervision and particular scrutiny of things like the hold-to-maturity portfolios being underwater and liquidity and the uninsured deposits are all going to be factors in. So the direction of travel is going to be tighter supervision.
Yeah. Would you suggest our central bank will have to adapt to the political realities of Republicans hugely distrustful of the big accumulation of capital, almost in a Jacksonian way? How big will that umbrella extend out from the too big to fails?
I think it's going to certainly extend into a number of the names that are in that 100 to 250. I remind you, that was actually by statute in 2018. The statute said that less prudential scrutiny for banks under 250 billion. But again, the legislation gives the Fed a lot of autonomy within that on an individual bank basis. And we're going to see that, I think, with tighter supervision.
What we just saw, though, a lot of people are pointing the finger at the Federal Reserve and saying that they should have had more supervision of this bank and that this was a policy failure that has really interfered now with their ability to raise rates elsewhere. Do you think that that's fair? Do you think that this was a policy mistake, or do you think that this is a direct result of rolling back that aspect of Dodd-Frank in 2018?
Well, I've looked into it a little bit. Again, you know, I'm no longer in that building or talking to those folks. The interesting thing, Lisa, is that the stress tests that were set up very successfully after Dodd-Frank typically looked at scenarios with deep recessions, high unemployment, and falling interest rates. And SVP would have done great in that scenario. They didn't have a lot of direct exposure in lending or the like. But what they did have, obviously, is a lot of exposure in long duration treasuries and mortgages. In particular, there's something called a global market shock that looks into that. I've also seen some work that indicates, again, I can't judge, but that SVP would have passed the standard Fed liquidity test. So clearly, I think they're going to be studying this. I don't want to prejudge where they end up, but I think that is going to be reviewed and changed.
That said, Rich, and this is a point that Neil Dutta made, and he's going to be on later in the show. He said, you know, the Fed basically has hiked a lot. Why are they surprised by duration risk? And why is it being treated as a bug rather than a feature of the hiking program? From your vantage point, do you think that perhaps there has been a bit of complacency about the resilience of an economy that so far hasn't broken, but now is starting to show some more acute strains?
I don't think I'd use the term complacency. What I would say is I broadly agree with Neil in the direction of travel. Look, when you raise rates, you invert the yield curve on a sustained basis. That is intended to tighten financial and credit conditions, and it is tightening financial and credit conditions. I hope nobody in the building thought that we could get to this point without there being a tightening in lending. Now, importantly, and let me get this on the table, what the Fed did Sunday night was exactly the right move. It's essentially expanding the discount window authority to lend against good collateral, which has been in place since 1913. And that's an entirely appropriate thing for the Fed to do, to give institutions liquidity against their security portfolio. So I think that was right. But yes, I'm broadly in that camp that when you raise rates and you invert the curve, you're going to make lending more expensive and intermediaries are going to bear some of that burden, absolutely.
How much more likely is a hard landing, in your view, a recession that does inflict some more pain today than, say, a week ago?
It's certainly more likely. You know, I've been in the camp consistently, I think, since doing your show last fall, that we more likely than not, we will see a recession with a rise in unemployment and some negative prints on GDP. Again, when you have a rate hike cycle of this magnitude, and how quickly that is going to be the outcome. But yeah, have the odds of a hard landing gone up? They certainly have. I don't think that's my baseline for a hard landing, but sure, the odds have to have gone up somewhat.
Richard, I just want to finish on this line that you often hear when central banks don't do something you expected them to do. And you hear things like, they might know something we don't know. Does the Fed ever know something we don't know?
Well, look, the short answer is yes, not often and not to a great degree. I tell you one situation where we didn't know anything that people didn't know was about the coronavirus. And so we didn't have any special briefings or insight.
What about banking troubles, Richard? If there were banking troubles behind the scenes, are they things that the Fed would know about but wouldn't talk about?
Sure. Well, yes, because the Fed has supervisors on the ground with thousands of banks at a very granular level, and so certainly some of that information is not in the public domain, and appropriately so.
That's why things become so speculative, Tom, in the next week going into this decision. It's so difficult for this Fed chair.
Should we have Claret on tomorrow? Can we get him on for another?
I think he's joining us every day. You're out next week. What you don't know is that Richard Claret is going to be...
He's guest hosting
He's going to be guest anchoring
that's good.
Next week. Richard, thank you, sir, for being with us.
Thank
what an
you.
Important morning. Richard Claret there, the former Fed chair, Fed vice chair, and currently of PIMCO. Dominic Konstam does not have laryngitis. He's got to make a call. He's the head of macro strategy at Mizuho Americas. Dominic, let's start here. ECB first. How much daylight is there between what you think they should do and what you expect they will do?
Not too much. I mean, I think they are a little bit behind the Fed in terms of raising real rates and fighting inflation. So if I were to expect the Fed, for the sake of argument, to stop, and the ECB was expected to raise 50, it's pretty easy for them to just scale that back and sort of signal that they're almost done. But I would expect them to sort of still push rates a little bit higher.
In famous Konstam 2020 hindsight, Dominic, you absolutely nailed it. On this show a number of weeks ago, you pounded the table, a lonely table, saying they are super restrictive. As they go into these set of meetings, are they still super restrictive?
Yeah, I mean, financial conditions are actually tightening through all of this. You know, the idea is, I don't know if you recall last year, there was this Fed paper talking around sort of our double star. That's, you know, we won't know it until we see it. And I think the idea is that we're seeing it now, that rates have basically beginning to sort of break aspects of the financial system, particularly in the US, which is a different situation than, say, Europe. Yeah, I mean, absolutely super restrictive. I think it's part of the speed with which rates have gone up. So you can sort of maybe revisit these levels in a more calmer tone. But the fact is, if you want to fight inflation, you better sort out your financial system first. You can't fight inflation and solve a financial system at the same time by raising rates.
Dominic, we're expecting to hear from Janet Yellen later this morning that everything is fine in the financial system, that we have real resilience. What would it say from your vantage point to risk markets if the Fed comes out and says, you know what, we were wrong, inflation isn't the preeminent concern, and even though everything is stable, we're not going to raise rates anymore? Don't you think that that could potentially be a liability for some of the riskier assets?
Well, the issue for the financial system, in a sense, if you say it's fine from a capital perspective, that's largely true. But obviously, it's from a liquidity perspective that you've got the issue. And we saw it in the gilt market last year, whereby liquidity problems can become solvency problems for, you know, in that example, the insurance sector. And that's what you're seeing in the medium-sized banks. So it is true you can say, you know, financial system is fine, but you've got to focus on liquidity. And on that basis, you have to kind of, when the liquidity problems coming from the so-called, you know, risk-free rate and the treasury yield curve that's attached to that, then that's your problem. So you can't basically fight inflation. And I agree that does maybe give people a cause for concern around the credibility around inflation. But the other thing that we've been arguing for a while is this inflation is sticky and it's almost beyond the control of the Fed. There's a time element with which inflation will come down that the Fed can't necessarily control.
Dominic Konstam, you invented the linkage of quantitative finance into economics at Credit Suisse with Neil Sass years ago. You do have experience at Credit Suisse, to say the least. Can you imagine UBS merging with the Credit Suisse you know?
Oh, absolutely, yes. I mean, that's. I think that's the... what the Swiss National Bank has done is obviously extremely important, a massive liquidity facility. There are a lot of idiosyncratic problems, obviously, at Credit Suisse. It's kind of fairly intuitive that in the long run or the medium term, some sort of resolution would involve the Swiss banks finding some kind of tie-up. Good bank, bad bank, whatever you want to call it. The main thing about Credit Suisse is they have a wonderful private bank, and that's what they kind of want to preserve. And investment bank is, you know, it is what it is.
Would that private bank be valuable to other UK, continental, or American banks? I mean, there's a mystery here to the new culture of Credit Suisse. Do you denote a new culture?
I'm not a bank analyst, but I mean, I would say the private bank has always been the sort of jewel in the crown, and it's been very impressive. And I would absolutely imagine it would be attractive to a lot of people. Yes,
I think we're all bank analysts this week. Dominic, thank you. You know, Dominic Konstam, thank you, sir, of Mizuho.
Get a concise daily market update from Charles Schwab, including the latest on U.S. and global economic news, stock updates, monetary policy decisions, and key results and statistics that may impact your trading. Schwab Market Update is an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Join host Keith Lansford for this information-packed daily market recap, delivered in 10 minutes or less. Listen today at schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast or wherever you get your podcast. That's schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take and Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's go straight to the guest, Peter Oppenheimer, Chief Global Equity Strategist at Goldman Sachs. Peter, great to catch up with this really difficult moment, so thanks for carving out some time in your schedule.
Thank you.
You did like European banks. The facts have changed in the last week. Do you still like them?
We do. Clearly, in a situation like this, there's massive uncertainty, and I think the volatility that you've been speaking about and Lisa discussed is going to continue. But I do think it's important to recognize the underlying fundamentals here are pretty good. You've got strong capital buffers, core tier one capital of around 15% compared to about 5% for the European banks during the crisis in 2008. You've got stable funding dynamics, 1.8 trillion of excess deposits, and you've got very ample liquidity. And the liquidity coverage ratio is around 150% at the end of last year. So it's a very different fundamental situation. And indeed, rising interest rates, which we've been seeing, is actually very good for the banks. But, you know, confidence is everything. And while this uncertainty continues, they're likely to remain volatile. But they are cheap, and I think they're fundamentally in a relatively strong place.
Peter, we note your decades of experience in seeing multiple crises. I know you've been to Zurich any number of times and know that what matters is to take lunch at the Kronenhall, Das Restaurant Kronenhall. That's what everybody does in Zurich. It's the only place to eat. I get it. But when you're eating there now in this crisis at Kronenhall, is Switzerland part of Europe, or is Switzerland still separate from Europe amid this crisis?
Well, I don't think in a banking crisis that anything is really separate, and particularly in a banking situation where you've got cross-border integration and connectivity. So other central banks around the world will be talking to the Swiss authorities, and I think will be also preparing statements or willing to provide as much liquidity that's required if the situation continues to unwind. Obviously, there's a difficult decision that the ECB have got to make, as Lisa was saying earlier. But I think, again, they will emphasize the robustness of the underlying system and their readiness to provide liquidity using some of the existing tools that they already have, potentially providing more. But I think they'll take some comfort from the underlying balance sheet strength of the banking sector in Europe, which, of course, we couldn't have said a decade ago. So I think from that perspective, it's a much more robust underlying situation.
Peter, will you still be bullish on European banks if the ECB does not hike rates today and indicates that they're on pause until they have more clarity?
I think that it's very unlikely they'll say they're on pause, because that will, if anything, provide some sort of sense that they're concerned about the contagion effects of this. I think they've got to look at the underlying fundamentals of the economy. Actually, that's looking pretty good. We don't expect a recession this year in Europe. Inflation, core inflation, underlying inflation is above their target rate. They've signaled quite strongly that they expect to raise rates by 50 basis points. And the banking system, again, as I would say, appears fundamentally resilient. And so I think they would want to sort of stay the course, but at the same time provide statements that are reassuring about their willingness to provide liquidity, to emphasize existing tools that are in place and that have been built up over the last few years since the sovereign debt crisis, and their ability to look at other things as well if it's required.
And Peter, do you think that tighter financial conditions, tighter lending standards are just inevitable now after what we've seen in the last week?
Yes, I do. And I think this is all really a function of a massive shift in the cost of capital that we've been seeing over the last year and a half. I mean, you know, you only have to go back a year and a half, and about a quarter of all government debt around the world had a negative yield. You know, people were paying for the privilege of lending money to governments. That world has changed. You're getting close to 5% on US dollar cash with zero volatility and risk. And that's a high hurdle for asset markets to pass. But it also means that there is a tightening in financial conditions and a rise in the cost of capital, which is inevitably having an impact on pushing valuations of assets down. And it's clearly causing some friction in areas of the financial markets. But if the underlying situation is robust and the capital buffers are in place, it won't prevent these problems, but may restrict the contagion and the systemic fallout from them. And that's I think, you know, fundamentally the important point to take away from this.
A delicate moment. Peter, we appreciate your time this morning. Thank you.
Peter, thank you.
Peter Oppenheimer there of Goldman Sachs.
I think they're going to look asymmetrically, and they're going to say, if we make decision A, what does it mean on an asymmetric basis, B and C as well? And to give us clarity on that, not only in the United States, but in a Europe that surprised a lot of people with optimism, is Neil Dutta. He's head of U.S. economic research at Renaissance Macro, and he has absolutely nailed the resilient American economic experiment over the last number of quarters. Neil, wonderful to have you with us, and try to get away from talking about banking crisis. Just in all of your study of economics at NYU, Neil Dutta, is it just simple the ECB will ignore the data and the ECB will be on plan as scheduled?
I don't know. That's an open question. My own sense is that they probably don't go 50. I mean, remember, wasn't it Lagarde that was picking up the phone and telling Hank Paulson how terrible of a decision it was for him to let Lehman go under. So, view, she,
Again, we'll see that in the next.
That she's probably going to err on the side of caution here.
And we'll see that again in the next hour here with daylight savings time in America. And you know, I've never heard Dutta talk about ECB, so that's pretty cool. You know, well, that's what a crisis will do to you.
This is a moment where all experts in random things that just seem to pop up from day to day. And that's sort of the question that I have for you is, how do you even chart a path forward when the facts change this quickly? And they are material because this leads to an actual tightening in credit conditions and lending.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. I mean, the question is part of the reason why the economy was so resilient, remember, was that it wasn't especially credit sensitive to begin with, right? That's one of the reasons why, the folks talking about long and variable lags for the last 18 months then shifted to talking about the weather, then shifted to talking about seasonal adjustment issues, and now are saying, oh, look, the lags finally kicked in. You know, sometimes in this business, Lisa, it's better to be lucky than good.
Well, and this raises this issue of how do we even know what our biggest challenge, what our biggest threat is? And I go back to what Nouriel Roubini was saying, which is if the Fed pauses, if the ECB pauses, this could allow an unmooring of inflation expectations at a time when you do have an economy with strength. What is your concern about that? Is that still a preeminent risk, or will the tightening take care of itself?
No, absolutely. I think it's a risk. I mean, I don't think what's happened right now in the banking system, as unnerving as it may be, is enough to really, send the U.S. economy into a below potential growth state. I mean, remember, as the data make clear, we went into this with a lot of momentum, right? You're talking about Atlanta Fed tracking 3.5%, and you're talking about inflation running 5%. So you're talking about an 9% nominal growth environment. That helps grease the wheels a little bit. So, you know, even though the data is stale, let's try to remember that the momentum going into all this is pretty robust. And that gives us a bit of a shock absorber once this goes on. At the same time, the inflation data are not encouraging. I mean, people looking at PPI and saying, oh, you know, this is a reason for them to back off. I mean, it's absolutely ridiculous. core inflation is running hot. Inflation is been so strong over the first 2 months of the year that if it didn't do anything for the rest of the year, it'd still be up 1%. So, I think the risk is if they pause, they may have to come in later, and then they may have to be even more aggressive. So I tend to sympathize with that view.
Neil, give me a level here. One of my great themes is Europe just flat out does not have a nominal GDP persistency like America. We are generally, because of technology and maybe a different demographic and economy, set at a higher level. If I'm right on that, what's your run rate on nominal GDP?
I think we're in a 5-6% underlying nominal growth environment right now. You talk about 2-2.5% real growth, around 4% inflation. So, 6%, I think, is a reasonable benchmark.
And that seems to me to be pretty constructive as well. Can they pause, ECB today or a Fed here in a number of days, can they pause with a strong statement that they will resume rate hikes as appropriate at some point.
I mean, they could do that, but I mean, my sense was in reading the events of last weekend and what the Fed has done, my assessment is it goes back to the Bernanke discussion about using the right tools for the right job. What they did was try to ring fence the banking system to create the space for themselves to keep hiking, to deal with slowing down the economy, and underlying demand. Remember, rates are a blunt tool that affects, you know, all industries at the same time, right? Not just the banking sector. So I thought in some ways you can make the argument that what they did over the weekend was a way to create the space to ultimately hike. At the margin, obviously, it makes 50 basis points less likely. You can't talk about a systemic risk exception and still go 50. But I think you can make a reasonable argument to keep going 25. The data remain quite strong. And we're not at a point yet that suggests significant economic damage as a result of this. As Michael McKee mentioned, I mean, home building stocks have been doing well. Housing can't work if credit isn't flowing to households.
Neil, just quickly here, has a chance of a very hard landing or a harder landing become more likely in the past week as we've seen some of the tensions come to the fore?
Yes, it has, because I think the biggest risk of a hard landing is if the Fed follows the market's pricing of interest rates. Because the markets, the fixed income market has an implicit dovish bias. And if the Fed follows that, it risks entrenching inflation, which further will push the Fed away from where the markets are. And that will risk a much harder adjustment later.
Neil Dutta, thank you so much for the Renaissance Macro Research this morning. Subscribe to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live every weekday starting at 7 a.m. Eastern. On Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can watch us live on Bloomberg Television and always on the Bloomberg Terminal. Thanks for listening. I'm Tom Keene, and this is Bloomberg.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcasts.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV+.